Hello, this is Leslie Garfield-Tenzer, and this is Legal Tenzer, casual conversations on noteworthy legal topics. Equity in law school, and really all higher education, is a critical issue that addresses ensuring fair and unbiased access to educational opportunities. My guest today, Dean Michael Hunter-Schwartz, is the leader in promoting the kind of equity necessary to enhance any student's access to the law profession. His books like What Best Teachers Do and his Contracts Casebook, which reimagines the traditional casebook with an academic support bent to it, are just some small evidence of the profound impact Dean Schwartz has had on law school teaching. Today, he's here to discuss equity-promoting initiatives in law school across the entire legal educational experience. And I want to thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Leslie. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Me too. Let's start at the very beginning. What do you mean when you talk about or say equity-promoting initiatives?
So what I really mean is something, as you suggested in your intro, that runs the full gamut of the operations of a law school. So it isn't just whom you admit, what criteria you use for admissions, or academic support, or bar pass support. It runs all the way through fundraising, alumni relations, marketing, curriculum, student evaluations of faculty, faculty self-evaluations, outcome reporting. A real equity focus would have you go way beyond just simply raw numbers of students. And to be honest with you, you know, the traditional way we've been talking about in legal education since this anti-racism effort hit law schools was to focus exclusively on faculty and staff professional development. It's just so much bigger than that.
No, I agree. I mean, especially when you talk about faculty and staff development, professional development, I think we focus on professional development for law students for the profession in terms of how to dress for a courtroom and that kind of thing. But you're living in a bigger world than that. So what kind of projects or what kind of programs would you envision for students?
So on the student side of things, I'm going to sort of talk about student sort of professional development, the kinds of things that the new ABA standards requires law schools to teach students about bias and those kinds of things. And I think what the ABA requires is one in the early part of their education, one before a second one before they graduate. And to me, that sort of sets a minimum floor. But I think that there's sort of a broader thing there that is really, really critical, which is one of the things we've moved to now is during orientation, our students create a code of expectations of each other in terms of civil disagreement. And so we have them work in small groups. They do some reading beforehand. Each small group creates a code of expectations. We then synthesize it, send it back to the students, and then send it to the upper division students. And the faculty and staff and students all approve it. And then we distribute it and we'll start all over again in the fall.
Wow, that's amazing. So, I mean, I know you don't have it in front of you, but can you off the top of your head say some example of that or give us an example of that?
Yeah, so there's like about 12 provisions. Afterwards, I could send you a link if there's any use of that for you. But they came up with things that you and I would hope they would come up with, like focus on the idea and not the person. Both intent and impact are important, but also make sure that you understand the difference between intent and impact in anything that anyone is saying. Ask questions before assuming. Try to stand up when someone seems to be being attacked by other people in the room. Kind of those kinds of basic principles of being a kind, good, caring human being.
That's amazing. Well, you know, and it's never my intent on this podcast to get political, but we did weather October 7th. And I know that at our school, we had some snafus, we'll call them, you know, some issues. I'm wondering, did you feel that this kind of experience for the students that happened when they first entered law school, which I'm assuming is like August or September, helped smooth the way for getting through that time?
And I will say, and maybe it was dumb luck, so I can't take any credit at all, but we actually went through that period incredibly smoothly. I did send a communication from me to the community that tried to be reflective of what we had talked about. So I acknowledged from the outset that no matter what I would say, there's a decent chance that one or both of groups of students would feel pain as a result of what I was saying. And so starting from that sort of emotionally humble place. And then I also announced that we were going to have a conversation between, we have a faculty member who's Palestinian American, and then we borrowed a faculty member from Carnegie Mellon, because he happens to be the husband of our provost, who's an expert on Israel. My colleague had been involved in negotiating the Camp David Accord. And so they had a conversation, which we also had no incidents, events, or anything else between them about what was happening. So we got really lucky. I wish I could say I was some kind of a genius, but no, it was just pure luck.
Well, I don't know if you were lucky. I think that you were creating a code of ethics that includes the students. I mean, that's the other thing that I think is so interesting about what you're suggesting. And one of the things we can talk about next is student evaluations of faculty teaching. But there tends to be in education, at least legal education, this idea that top down, that we impose on them our own set of rules. And you're empowering your students with this idea that they get to be collaborative in the rule setting agenda.
Yes. And in fact, we went back to the 1Ls in January. Are we still in January? No, we're now in February.
We're now in February.
And asked them.
Groundhog Day.
Ask them, is there anything in the rules they would change? And so we're going to send out some revisions based on the student input. The other thing I wanted to say about student support is if we're going to be working towards equity, we want to be thinking about the kinds of things that end up being barriers to student success. So a great example is food insecurity. Lots of law schools have what I would call a traditional food bank. The student walks into a room, there's dry goods all over. They walk out with bags. Everyone knows they're struggling. About 3.5 years ago, we created a virtual food bank. Our students walk into the dean of students office, for which they would walk for 100 different reasons, and they come out with a $100 grocery card for a local grocery. And so we've given out more than $50,000 worth of those $100 grocery cards since we launched it. It's an easy thing for philanthropy. Even people, you know, there are always going to be alumni that are a little upset with you. Not a lot of them, but always some from 20 years, 50 years ago. One doesn't want to give to having people being able to eat. And so it's been very easy to raise money for. And so that's a good example. Another example would be on the bar exam. There are students who can't afford to take the time off to study for the bar. And so we created a stipend and raised money for a stipend to allow students to be able to take time off to study for the bar exam. So when you think about student success and supporting students, it's really much, much more broader than just the things we address in faculty and staff professional development.
The only problem is that after hearing this, everyone's going to want to go to McGeorge Law School. I already want to go to McGeorge Law School. So let's talk about student evaluations. I have some issues with student evaluations. I feel that some faculty teach to the evaluations. I feel that the students who fill out the evaluations, if they're not going to be compelled, are the outliers, those who really hate the professor or those who really love the professor, more those who hate them. I mean, it's like Yelp, pretty much. So I know that you included in your list of equity promoting initiatives the idea of student evaluations. How do you give students power through student evaluations without compromising the integrity of the classroom from the faculty members' perspective?
It's a great question. Part of it on the faculty side is how much you weigh those evaluations in evaluation of faculty. If you make them basically are delegating to the students the job of faculty evaluation, then I see it as really problematic because we know that women and faculty of color often do worse on evaluations and that people teach to them. But what I was specifically thinking about there is that we've added a question to our annual student evaluation, classroom evaluations, not annual, but classroom evaluations. To what degree does the professor create an inclusive classroom atmosphere? And then what did the professor do that did so or did not do so? So that we've included our commitment to creating an equitable classroom experience specifically, and then our faculty self-evaluations. And for those who are listening to us who don't know, most law schools I've been, faculty do an annual report to the dean on what they did over the previous year. And we added three questions to the annual faculty self-evaluations that were equity promoting. One, what did you do to create an inclusive classroom atmosphere? Two, how did you integrate issues of race and equity into your subject or subjects, I guess it would be. And then three, there's a lot of literature out there that faculty of color end up doing what's called invisible labor, where the students of color sort of come to them when they're feeling the stress of law school and the imposter syndrome that sometimes is an issue. And so we both included a reference to invisible labor, defined it, and asked people to report the invisible labor that they did as part of their self-evaluation. So it would count towards service.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting to counter towards service. I mean, that's really a so for those who don't know, faculty are teach, write, and serve. And service can be committee, but you're to your point, service could be promoting equity in some kind of extraordinary ways, I guess you would say. Well, do you have any suggestions, or you identify any ways that faculty are promoting inclusion other than kind of the traditional allowing people to speak about cases that raise issues of racism or, social economic issues? I mean, what has any kind of interesting different types of things that you've heard of?
Yes, and the other thing I should say is that my wife and I funded an annual faculty award to the faculty member who has done the most to innovate to create an equitable classroom environment for students.
Oh, so now not only are the students going to want to come, now the faculty want to come to McGeorge. That's wonderful.
Well, thank you for the marketing. And so I think a lot of things is, if you ask me, like the biggest thing is humility. Students, and I'm in California, a very, very, very progressive state like New York, and I'm in Sacramento, which was once a purple region, but it now is extremely blue. There's been a conversion of our region where I think we're the most diverse city in the United States. So it's a really interesting place, and so students don't expect faculty members who are as friggin' old as I am to get everything perfectly. What they really want is humility. And so a student says, "Hey, look, you did this in your class." And I think sort of being open to the idea of something that you've done for 20 years, 30 years in teaching, now feeling painful for students and sharing that candidly, is all our students really want. And so if you ask like, what's the great innovation? Actually, that's a big one, humility.
Wow, that's an easy, well, not for all professors, but that is an easy give, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, it's true. I've been teaching forever too, and it's really interesting to see when I first started teaching, the only pronoun you used when we were talking about a hypothetical was he. And then it became he and she, and now it's he, she, and they. So it's really been a very positive progression through, through time, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yes, and over time, we learn that, I had a final exam when I was a student in crim law that had horrible violence against Jewish people. I don't know why the professor chose to do that in his final, but it did. And I'm a Jewish law student. I'm like, what the heck is the message this dude is saying? But for me, there's a lesson there that we need to think about our hypotheticals from the lens of a person who doesn't need the added stress and worry about, like, why is the professor choosing to have violence against a person based on their identity?
Right.
And so it's
And
partially.
names.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even mean, but I'm really, careful that I use a diverse set of names and not, just kind of John and Jane.
Yes. And it's filled with nuance because, of course, one of the people we studied for the Best Law Teacher book that I wrote several years ago was a crim law professor. And he always started his crim law class by saying, "It's very upsetting to me that so many of the defendants in the cases I teach are described as black." And so I just want to acknowledge that now and let you know I see that as really problematic so that everyone sort of knows that. Or maybe it was crim pro, but in any event, and so it's sort of so in that instance, maybe when you're crafting a hypothetical in crim law, maybe you don't want to have a name that sounds like it's a person of color. I mean, it's like, so it's that
Right, right.
the hyper thoughtful thing that I think is really important.
And I think, and how does that translate into an easier learning experience for a student?
So here's my thought, and God knows it's like I don't think this has been studied, but I sort of think there's a real difference between a hypothetical that raises a racial justice issue where the student, there's no stakes in terms of the students getting a good grade in the class, and a hypothetical that's on an exam where I feel like we should be doing everything we can to have it be a distraction-free experience. It's only about understanding and applying what they've learned. And so I think it's valuable to be thoughtful about who are the alleged characters of our hypotheticals, as you've suggested. But really, like I would say, it depends on the moment. Because in the moment, if the professor says, well, I included this because I wanted to raise this racial justice issue in my hypothetical. And so the students don't see it as, oh, the professor may have been wanting us to feel bad. On an exam, the professor can't do that. And so it creates that speculation. You could still raise, I really believe you could still raise the really critical racial justice issues in our society. It's just sort of when, and from my perspective.
And so what would you say to a new older faculty member? Because I think the younger faculty members are much more sensitive to all of this. But what advice would you give to a new older faculty member who's been in the profession for, say, 30 years and is now going into the classroom on how to make the classroom feel inclusive?
So I would start with that humility thing. That would be number one. Like, and let them know that our students don't expect perfection. They really only expect willingness to learn and humility. I would say the second thing is that I know this is a major controversy in higher education. I'm 30 years into teaching. So when I know a case or a set of cases are going to cause controversy. So I teach a seminar on the U.S. Supreme Court even to this day, and we were going to discuss Casey and Dobbs. And so I went into it saying, I know that I have students for whom preserving the right to reproductive freedom is a core belief, and they're really upset about what happened in Dobbs. And I also know that we have people in this room who are think that Dobbs was right. And so I want to sort of acknowledge that because this topic has emotional content, that all of us are going to be feeling that. So like nothing like, you might call that a trigger warning. I don't use that term. I just sort of say, you know, let's be empathic and caring about each other so that we can have a good discussion.
You know, I think that's great advice. It's permission to be who you are and permission to let your feelings come through class. And when I went to law school, there was no permission to do any of that. Like you did, of course, when I went to law school, and I think you probably went to law school around the same time I did, you left class not knowing anything anyway. So yes. It didn't really matter.
Yes, absolutely.
So I have one last question for you. And that question is, what advice would you give to students who are struggling at their schools because they feel unseen?
So here's the first thing I would say is that it's very easy for people who don't see a lot of people who look like them to feel unseen. And there are some things that reinforce that. So I want to first say that this is a thing. So for example, students who have a difficult to pronounce name, if you ask me like, what's their biggest complaint about faculty? Faculty are so afraid of getting it wrong. They don't call on them at all.
Oh, so interesting.
So it gives them even more of a sense of feeling unseen. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that problem's really solvable because you could just, as the professor say, here's how I think your name is pronounced. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Even if I get it wrong four times, please correct me. I'm going to try to get it right. And right. So that's humility. Like, I guess I'm obsessed with humility today. So that's the first thing is I tell the students, this is part of being a human being. And actually I also share with them that when I was in law school, and then again, when I was a lawyer, and then again, when I became a law professor, I went through, and then again, when I became a dean, lots of self-doubt about whether I really belonged in the role that I was in each of those roles, that it's also a normal human thing. The second thing I would say is find a person on the faculty that you do or on the staff that you feel safe with and really sort of share what you're going through. One of the great things, I guess, maybe because I'm so old, I'm going to say something that's going to make me sound really old, is one of the great things about life is that ability to have human connection. And we know that sharing vulnerability actually brings people in to want to connect to you. And so I would say, tell somebody. You'll be surprised how much you'll be inviting someone in to help you navigate it.
That's great advice. That's great advice. Any other advice you want to share before we say our goodbyes?
About the only other thing I would say is that as I've been working at McGeorge towards becoming an anti-racist law school, and I really do think it's an asymptote, we're never going to get there in my time at least, because every time I learn about something new, I realize, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. So that's my first thing is that it's an aspiration. It's going to take a long time to change a long, 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 long history. The second thing I would just say is that part of our obligation as institutions, even if we don't publicize it outwardly, is to track outcomes data, that we should be able to say, what are our academic attrition rates for students of color and for white students? What are our bar pass rates for students of color and white students? And what are our job placement rates? And so I could tell you right now, our academic attrition rates are identical. About every other bar, our white students do better, or our students of color do better. And the last 4 years in a row, our students of color have done better on job placement. And so I just think that there's a saying in higher education that we only respect what we inspect. And so if we don't inspect our outcomes because we're afraid, then we can't do anything about it. And then we don't make changes to try to make progress.
Such good advice. And I just want to echo one thing, which is I find this is a problem with me. Like, I don't know what I don't know. So unless someone says to me, you don't know this, I don't even know that I don't know it, not to be repetitive. So, and that goes to your humility, right? That we have to be willing to acknowledge that we are fallible. Thank you so much for taking the time. This has been really enlightening. I'm certainly going to send it along to my dean, but I think that your initiatives are really impressive and really important. And I encourage anyone listening to take advantage of some of them and bring them into your own homeschool. So thank you.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, or a professor or attorney with whom you'd like me to speak, send us an email at legaltensor@westacademic.com and send us any suggestions you may have. We love getting feedback. Have a great day. This podcast was created in collaboration with West Academic. Additional episodes can be found on West Academic Study Aids Collection. Students may already have access through their school subscription and can check with their law school library for access. For a limited time, Legal Tensor listeners can save 15% on titles on the West Academic store with the promo code TENSOR15 at checkout.